Hi, I'm Charlie Bromley. And for one of the first times, I'm on my dad's podcast. Yay! And my thoughts about Endgame were, I thought it was really good, and for my personal favorites, I thought Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was really good, and it was my favorite movie for a while, like ever since 2018, and when I saw Endgame, it beat Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse of my favorites by 0.0001%.
Hi, I'm Rosie. I am 6¾. My favorite part of Endgame was I got to see some of my favorite characters in the battle. And one of the dudes, I think Meep, was playing Fortnite, which I want. Fortnite does not suck.
This movie.
And now it's time for F this movie.
Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined for our annual Year So Far episode, plus talking Avengers Endgame.
It's a double feature.
With the mightiest Avenger I know, JB.
It's true, and let me tell you, this year isn't as bad as you're thinking.
Okay.
Off the top of your head, you're like, pretty bad year. But when you actually sit down and examine the list, not as bad as you might think.
Well, that's encouraging. Because
that's my thesis.
We do this show every year, and my feeling was, A, people are expecting us to talk Avengers Endgame, so we have to work that into the podcast. And B, I felt like, well, I don't have as much to say about this year so far. I haven't seen as much.
And I don't have as much to say about Avengers Endgame. Although I enjoyed it, and I thought it was terrifically entertaining.
Yeah, so we decided to combine the two shows.
Two mints in one.
Exactly. So we're going to be talking about Avengers Endgame, and then we'll probably move into the year so far. But first, J-Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
Yes, I saw Avengers Endgame.
Oh, great. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
And, well...
It's a lot of movie.
You did a podcast on Pet Sematary.
I did.
Which I have not listened to yet.
Okay.
So you're going to have to excuse me.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, Robin. I'm a little behind. I went to see it, and I liked it. I liked it a lot more than the two people I saw it with. I thought it was at least nice that they were taking it seriously. There were actors in it I liked. And now, since I've seen it, which is almost a month ago, it's... status is falling for me. The more I think about it, apparently I wasn't smart enough to figure out the ending. And then when my wife explained to me exactly what I was seeing at the end, that was a callback to that first shot that seemed to be a flash forward, I liked it a lot less because I thought the filmmakers were leaving it up to you.
No.
No, not at all.
There's a sound effect and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So... imagine if the last shot exists without the thing at the very beginning and without the sound effect.
I still don't like it.
Okay. Like I said, the more I think about it, the less I like it.
Yeah, I was not a fan, unfortunately.
And I defer to you because you're such a Stephen King fan.
Yeah.
King was doing all he could on Twitter, though, promoting it.
Sure.
I mean, he was going on and on.
Sure.
About how he admired the fact that they, this is a phrase you used to use, that they were owning how bleak and mean-spirited it was.
Sure.
I was angry that the marketing campaign
gave
away the twist.
Yes.
Because had I not seen any of the trailers or anything, I would have been fooled because you can see how the filmmakers are actually leading you down the path until the exact moment of the twist. And I felt cheated because that would have been interesting if it hadn't been spoiled for me.
I guess, but I still maintain that it's different for the sake of being different. Well, what should we do this time? I know. Let's do this instead.
Sure. And also, in the words of Adam Riske, I don't want to suggest that this is my thought. This is Adam's, and I think he's spot on. We wound up seeing it with him because he was in another part of the theater, but thanks to reserving your seats, he got back on the app and discovered that the seats next to us had not been sold, so he decided to sit there until they
were. Oh, got it.
And no one came because, so anyway. After the movie, he said he was scratching his head through the first half to figure out why that young girl was cast.
Okay.
And then when the events of the film transpire and perhaps she acts different in the second half, he said, oh, I get it. This is what she auditioned with, and this is why she got the part.
So, yeah, I was very disappointed in that.
Ultimately, I am too, although at the time I enjoyed it, and I'm such a John Lithgow fan, and I thought that his performance was trying, we talked about this the other day, that his performance was trying to fill in the holes in the script. We learn that he tells the father this information that may or may not be good because he has such feelings for the daughter. We never see a scene where it's established that they have a special bond.
No.
In fact, driving home, I suggested, and then later suggested that my wife suggested it, and she suggested that she never suggested that, that it was just me doing the suggesting, that there's about four dialogue scenes that seem to be missing that would really make the film much more plausible. That,
okay.
That one is just an example.
Right.
If he really has such strong feelings of attachment for the daughter and doesn't want the daughter to be sad because the cat died, then you have to give us a scene where somehow it's suggested beyond, well, she found him first. She was the first to run into the neighbor. And I love John Lithgow so much, and almost a week later on The Simpsons, he was the guest voice, and they were doing some crazy play live on television. Marge was directing it, and in this little, and they decided to put it on TV, so it becomes this big thing. They ran out of plots a decade ago. Now it's just maybe Homer makes folding tables, and Bart tries to stop him. So they're televising this big musical production that Marge has decided to direct, and Lithgow shows up at the as a guest voice. And because it's like regional theater, someone on the show says, John Lithgow, I didn't expect to see you. And there's a pause, and Lithgow says, I like to work. And I immediately related that to Pet Sematary,
sure,
where it might be getting harder for older actors. I also saw Us.
Okay. What?
Go ahead.
Nothing. I didn't know if we should save that for the year so far or if we should talk about it now. Either way.
Okay.
We could talk about it now. Did you like it?
I did.
Okay.
I liked it. I thought it was nice and scary and very entertaining. I was afraid through the entire thing, though, that do we really want a talent like Jordan Peele to be so pigeonholed? It seems like he's going down the M. Night Shyamalan path.
Yeah,
and that's, because Get Out made so much money and caused so much buzz, well, you're the racial allegory guy now, and this is what we want to see. And what was Shyamalan's follow-up to Sixth Sense?
Unbreakable.
Okay, and I'll give him a pass on that because I actually like Unbreakable a lot, but it might have been the 1-2 punch of both movies where he's now expected to do one thing.
Well, his next movie was The Village.
Which is,
and my feeling, and Erica's feeling, after seeing Us was, oh, Jordan Peele skipped right to The Village.
And I can see that because, in fact, my only quibble with Us, because I did find it scary, was that it bends over backwards, sometimes literally, to explain where these strange people came from, that whole alternate universe. And isn't it scary? Isn't it scarier if we don't know?
Well,
if they show up.
Yes, but then he's only making a horror movie. And he isn't just making a horror movie.
And not the social allegory that we now expect.
Which
and like
is
I
why
said,
we need...
I don't want to see him chained to that.
The movie was almost just like a weird semiotics experiment where it's just everything means something. Even the VHS tapes at the beginning foreshadow what's going to happen because everything has to mean something.
One of many actresses whose name I cannot pronounce no matter how much I try, her interpretation of the alternate universe mother,
yeah,
I thought was really quite a performance. I mean, you might say, well, it's a trick because she does a trick voice, but I found that very...
That too is explained, though.
Oh, sure.
You know.
Very creepy and very effective. Like many movies this year, I liked it while I was watching it. And I also finally got to go to the new Beverly Theater.
That's right.
I went to visit my son, and my son, a couple weeks before the trip, said, you know, Dad, sometimes he calls me Dad.
When he's not calling you a fuckface.
Well, I was going to make that joke, but I thought it came across odd coming out of my mouth.
So it's better if I make it?
Well, no, because it's usually asshole.
Oh, God.
He said, the Sunday night you're in town, Bridge on the River Kwai is at the New Beverly. And, of course, it's an original IB Tech print. This becomes very important later in the story. So I actually got to go to the New Beverly, and you've been there. It's like a pilgrimage. And it really made me appreciate the music box, because the music box is so much bigger.
Yes.
And so much, I don't know.
More opulent.
And fancier, and the concession stand is better, and obviously right. The bathrooms. For those of you who haven't been to the music box in a couple months, they redid the main bathrooms. It's something. But we got there early because we went to this barbecue place that was extraordinary, and we finished early. And the doors weren't going to open for an hour, and there was already a line. Now, obviously, I don't live in L.A., so I don't know what the demand is for Bridge on the River Kwai. But it seemed to me, on a Sunday night, where a new episode of Game of Thrones, in fact, that might have been the season premiere.
Okay.
Because I kept saying, you know, this might be empty because everyone's at home watching Game of Thrones. That a line started so early, and the only reason there was a line is because they don't open the doors until a certain time before the showtime. So by the time they opened the doors, the line was relatively long. But once they opened the doors, it was easily... the line was subsumed by the space right. of the place, and the show didn't sell out. So ultimately, there was no reason for a line. But I began to think, like the IB Technicolor print, these are very special people for whom every trip is part of the fetish.
Right.
And standing in line, and I have nothing against standing in line as long as it's you who's standing in line. I don't like to stand in line. And maybe even talking to other people in line is part of the fetish, and the fact that it's an original IB Technicolor print is part of the fetish too. Obviously, there's a cult around this place, and I'm really glad it exists. But as the film unspooled, I think I told you this already, it was beautiful to look at, but it's over 50 years old. So there's scratches and splices, and I have Bridge on the River Kwai at home on a 4K Blu-ray that looks like it was filmed yesterday. Now, maybe someone would say, sacrilege, that's not the film. This is the film, because this thing ran through a projector in 1956. But clearly that was part of the fetish of it.
Sure.
That you, it's almost like people who buy vinyl still instead of downloading, that you're doing it for the object.
Yeah.
And the people at the Beverly were doing it for the object, in which case, in this case, it being the print. I'm glad it exists. My son, who is very frugal, said he loves the Beverly because even when it's a double feature, there's one.
Yeah, right.
They don't charge extra. Right. And when you're on a budget.
Cheap too.
See, we had filled up on barbecue.
Right.
So I did not get to try their popcorn.
I remember it being good and not expensive.
Do you remember what you saw there?
I saw Young Dillinger. Is that a movie? Young Dillinger?
There was Warren Oates in it?
No. That's just Dillinger.
Right, that's just Dillinger.
It was black and white, and they had shown it as part of a double bill with Public Enemies, so it had to be young
was
Dillinger.
Was it Lawrence Tierney?
No. That's a different John Dillinger movie.
He played Dillinger.
This was something in between. This was like from the 50s or 60s. It was wild. Not a great movie, but certainly an experience.
And I know a week after I came home, he took his girl to see The Yakuza.
Nice.
And A Better Tomorrow. They were doing sort of Japanese action films, double features, even though Yakuza is.
I haven't seen Yakuza yet. I just got it from the Warner Archive sale.
Oh, I want to borrow it.
Okay.
Because that's the first script that Paul Schrader sold.
Right.
When he got to Hollywood, and I believe he wrote it with his brother.
Okay.
Because that was part of the lore.
I'm excited to see it, even though Sidney Pollack is not the first person I think of when I think of.
No, it actually surprises me that he directed it.
Yeah.
What have you seen lately?
What have I seen? Last night I saw a film that opens, I think, this Friday, probably on demand and in limited release because Shout Factory is actually putting it out. It's called I'll Take Your Dead, and it's a Canadian film about a man and his daughter who live on a farm, and the man sort of does freelance for various criminals who show up at his house and drop off their dead bodies, and he disposes of the bodies by cutting them up and putting them in an acid bath. And some criminals show up with a bunch of dead bodies and say, get rid of these, and one of them is not what we think it is, and I really liked it. It took me by surprise. I knew nothing about it. I didn't even know the name of it. I was sent a screening link.
That's the best way to
work. Right, and it was like, I don't know anything about this, so press play, and here we go. It combines some supernatural stuff, because it is a horror movie. The little girl is seeing ghosts, because she lives in this house with all this death. But at a certain point, the rules kind of go out the window in terms of who can see the ghosts and what the ghosts can do. And it's like they're either not in it enough or they're in it too much. So there's this really interesting little crime thriller, and then every once in a while there's ghosts. And it's like, I don't know that the two mesh particularly well, but that's kind of a quibble because I liked the movie a lot overall.
Well, this sounds right up my alley.
Yeah, it's worth checking out. I'm guessing, I think it opens May 3rd, and we'll probably get a VOD or an iTunes release. So, definitely worth checking out. The other movies I've seen are all newer movies, but they're all indies. I watched Body at Brighton Rock, which is the first feature directed by Roxanne Benjamin, who had done a segment in XX. Did you see XX, the anthology? The all-women directed
horror anthology? A lot of people were tweeting recently about Body at Brighton Rock.
Okay. A girl who's a park ranger kind of gets lost, stumbles upon a dead body. It's basically just her out in the wild. It was okay. I think I was excited to see it because I'm a supporter of Roxanne Benjamin. A lot of the crew she used were women, which I thought was encouraging. The movie itself feels kind of like a first movie. The premise is interesting, but there was just something about the photography that felt... maybe they just didn't have a huge budget, or she's still figuring out certain things with the camera. Not a waste of time, but I wanted to like it more than I did. Speaking of wanting to like it more than I did, I also saw Under the Silver Lake, the latest film from David Robert Mitchell, the director of It Follows. This is his follow-up, and was supposed to get a theatrical release from A24 and instead has kind of been dumped to VOD.
And did watching it explain why this happened?
Yeah.
Because It Follows, I think we're in agreement about this.
Yes.
It Follows is something.
Yes, I'm a big fan of It Follows. I think it was on Shockwaves, somebody compared it to Southland Tales. And that is an apt comparison.
So it's right up your alley.
It was not.
You love it, and you're now going to champion it.
I sat there the whole movie wondering, why do I have so much patience for the pretentious nonsense of Southland Tales and so little patience for the pretentious nonsense of Under the Silver Lake?
So this is like George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life. You actually had the experience that other people have watching Southland Tales.
Oh, believe me, I thought of that.
Without watching Southland Tales.
I was like, this is how everybody else reacted to that movie that I liked. Andrew Garfield plays a young man out in Los Angeles who meets a girl who subsequently disappears, and he essentially is trying to find her.
I've seen the trailer for this.
The trailer makes it look weird.
Yeah.
The movie is weird. It's sprawling. It's very Los Angeles.
I saw the trailer before Bridge on the River Kwai.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
It's super LA. So that was kind of neat. It's a lot of times weird for the sake of being weird. He's very clearly influenced by David Lynch and Alfred Hitchcock. And in case you don't know, the main character has Hitchcock posters all over his apartment. And at one point is standing at Hitchcock's grave. And the score is very Hitchcockian. A lot of like Rear Window references and kind of Vertigo references. And I just felt like it none of it added up to much. There's all these threads that are introduced that maybe could have been interesting that go completely unanswered. It's a movie that sort of works in sequences, but not all together. And I mean, the filmmaking is good. It's a well-made film. He knows what he's doing, but I found myself frustrated by it.
So do you think it should have gotten a theatrical release?
Sure. Nobody would have seen it, but, you know, put it out. Roll the dice.
Patrick Bromley says, if I ran the zoo.
Roll the dice. I don't think anybody would have seen it.
I'd release it. Can you?
It's a movie that is destined for a cult following because there will be people that love it and more power to them. I will not be among their ranks. And then I saw this other indie that we should probably talk about this weekend called Avengers Endgame.
Yeah, it's a smaller film.
Impressive cast.
It was in development hell.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
Years and years and years.
And just squeaked out over $1 billion. Just
that point just two that makes
out.
You wish.
Yeah. Could have gone for more.
Obviously, I'm surprised to be talking about Avengers Endgame because I thought naturally Adam Thass and Mike Pomero would be sitting. They actually can fit in this chair, the two of them. You should see. Pomero's on Thass's knee like a venture.
It's true.
You need to see it.
It's true.
Because I'm not Mr. Comic Book. But after you said, let's do this, I realized that with the exception of the second Thor movie.
Okay.
Where, and I think you're in this group, every person I've ever shared that with has said, don't worry about that. You really don't need to see that.
Yeah, it's not great.
The third one, on the other hand.
Lots of fun.
That's our friend Taika Waititi, who does a wonderful guest voice in Endgame. And at one point, my wife, who certainly knows more than me, thought for a second that when we see the rock guy from Thor Ragnarok, in Endgame, that was the Thing from the Fantastic Four. For just a second, she thought it was the Thing because, of course, the Fantastic Four is the one Marvel Comics thing that we can't figure out how to do right.
But now Disney has it, so maybe they'll figure it out.
Can I suggest two things?
Yes.
I've said this before.
Yes.
That was my hands. When I was a kid, yeah. I was a rabid Fantastic Four fan. You need to do it in period and look at it as a Mad Men.
This is what
go heavy on the 60s.
This is
stuff.
What Peyton Reed was going to do. Peyton Reed was going to direct that movie coming off of Down with Love.
And that,
and when I heard that, I was like, well, that's the greatest idea ever. Of course,
worked.
You should do that. And then
or,
they went a very different way.
Or animation, and not the Lion King remake animation. I'm not talking about CGI.
Right.
I'm talking about
right.
cell animation.
Well, that's
if the nature of this property with its. And we know what character I'm talking about. There's one. It's very difficult to do that and not have it be stupid.
The animated version is The Incredibles, you know?
But even The Incredibles doesn't include Ben Grimm. Ben Grimm is the sticking point. You can show someone invisible and show someone on fire and show someone bending, but the guy covered with rocks, that's a very difficult thing to do correctly.
Yeah.
And my proof is every other Fantastic Four movie.
Though I would argue the last one that came out, the Chronicle guy, Josh Trank.
Right.
You didn't see it.
No.
A disaster in every conceivable
way. Which is why I didn't see it.
Except for the execution of the thing. I mean, they do it CG, but it looks pretty good. That was not a sticking point for me in terms of here are all the things wrong with this movie. He was not one of them.
Because the conclusion I reached was that Ben Grimm as the thing is inherently comic book. That's so it can't, it has to be a drawing.
Right.
It,
okay.
Anyway.
Sure.
So I have seen every Marvel movie because I'm a movie fan and I want to go to see something. And I had gotten to the point where I thought Marvel movies were sort of, with the exception of occasional highlights like Ragnarok, that it was like chewing gum. That it's very pleasant when you're watching it and I don't have any quibbles. It's very entertaining. And then you would go home and you would sort of forget about it, which was right up their alley because then you would be ready for the next one. Right. But it has been 10 years, and I appreciate the fact that they're actually leaning into the fact that they've managed to keep this immense battleship going,
yeah.
You know. And I know that some of the people who listen to the podcast are big fans of the DC universe, but one of the reasons why I like the Marvel movie so much is that they don't go the route of DC, and I could sit here and enumerate the reasons why I don't like DC, or the fact that the only DC film I really like is Wonder Woman, and surprise, that's the one that's most like a Marvel movie. Am I?
Yeah, I think Aquaman tried. I didn't like Aquaman, but
Aquaman
I think
Aquaman was problematic.
They seemed, and I haven't seen Shazam yet, but they seem to be trying to get away from the thing that they were doing that was turning many of us off.
That it's dark, 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 dark,
right.
And I don't even think this is original to me. It always comes down to a scene where there's shit flying through the air.
Well, right. That's true of Marvel movies, too, though.
But speaking of shit flying through the air, this goes back to almost the beginnings of the podcast, that they make Iron Man, which is a movie I'm a big fan of,
yeah.
And then Marvel takes the wrong lesson and thinks that Iron Man is successful because there's two robots fighting at mm-hmm. the end, and they don't look at the first 45 minutes, which I think is the most successful origin story of a comic book character ever committed to film. Here's a guy in a cave, and we like
right.
him so much,
right.
we want him to live.
Right.
That's the reason why the movie was so popular. So when two CGI characters start whamming on each other, which happens in Endgame, I've said this before, I check out. Because it's a video game, and I punch you, and you fly across the wind, and you hit some sort of boulder, and then you come back, and you hit me, and I go flying. Even though that does happen a couple times in Endgame, I thought the sheer number of characters they had to keep in play
mm-hmm.
really kept that to a minimum. Because Kevin Smith, a big comic book fan, I've been told, had this wonderful tweet after he saw Endgame where he said the thing he was most impressed by was how many characters the film manages to keep in the air at the same time, because that isn't easy. And during the end credits, I used the wonderful personalized end credits to keep score as I was watching them, because the really main characters sort of get a curtain call
yeah.
where pictures of them are shown and then their signature is shown, like, ooh, they're okay, her contract is now up
right,
and his
right,
contract
right.
is now up and right. At the end of Endgame, and this is not a spoiler, there's 27 of them. That's hard.
Yeah.
That is hard to do.
Yeah.
And I think they pulled it off.
Yeah, I do too. There's a lot I feel like I want to say. I like superheroes. I grew up reading comic books. I grew up reading Marvel comic books. I've never approached these movies, though, with the enthusiasm of kind of a Marvel fanboy,
mm-hmm.
even though I've liked all of these movies.
Well, because you're approaching them as a movie lover.
Maybe.
That you're able to compartmentalize your love for Marvel, and you're going to see them as a movie guy, not a comic book guy.
And yet they still exist almost independently of movies. You can't compare Endgame to anything else because
true.
The achievement is so different. And I'll just say right now, just so that we don't mess up spoilers for Endgame, we just need to be able to talk about it openly.
I feel I haven't spoiled
it. You have not. But that's why I want to say it now. Right. I want to say it now just so that if we do want to talk specifics.
And I think we do later.
I really appreciate a lot of things that Marvel does. And I think these are movies, you know, as much as we're all lamenting Disney swallowing everything and having all, you know, and I know that the wrong lessons are going to be taken from the opening box office. And now the bar is this impossibly high thing that no one should even bother trying to clear.
Because it's a bar. You need to spend
10 years
making
22
movies.
Other movies, right, exactly.
To achieve. I mean,
all of which need to be successful and good. I appreciate that they make the movies good. They don't have to. We're all going to go see them. They don't have to be good. I mean, at a certain point, they do, because had 10 movies in, if they were all shitty, we would have stopped going.
It would sink.
Right. So the only reason they're able to get to Endgame is because they have so much goodwill from all of these movies and all of these characters. And I appreciate in this movie how much it rewards you for just being a fan of all these movies and being a fan of these characters, being a fan of the actors who are playing them. Everybody gets a little victory lap. And I realize that my affection for, like, Captain America in this series isn't born out of my affection for Captain America as a comic book character. I used to read Captain America comics. I liked him. But it has everything to do with Chris Evans' performance as Captain America. And I think that's true across the board, you know. I thought Infinity War did a good job of balancing all the different characters, because it threw everybody into different combinations. And, okay, we got these five heroes trapped
and
over here.
And I would say unexpected combinations.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is Infinity War. Thor and Rocket.
Right.
I thought that was an interesting pair-up, especially because he thought at that time that he was a rabbit.
And so I thought they did an interesting – I thought they took an interesting approach at balancing the gigantic cast. In this movie, actually, they have to balance far fewer cast members because most of them have disappeared and we're kind of back down to the original group plus Ant-Man and maybe a couple others.
Well, I had a question for you about that.
Okay.
Because this is such a large commercial enterprise. It made me wonder if contractually or because of actors' egos, if you had a lot to do in Infinity War, you're going to be taking a back seat through most of Endgame, and it sort of was their attempt to keep things fair in terms of screen time, because this is a narrative, and this is a film, and they are telling a story, but it's also a huge commercial enterprise, including, like I said, 27 actors who have agents and complicated contracts.
I think it has more to do with just wanting to get it back to the original group for this movie, knowing that, okay, this is the victory lap, this is the last time we're going to see this team together.
Because given how devastated a lot of people were after Infinity War came out with its ending, I was actually surprised, because I don't think about these things every day. It's been a year. I was surprised sitting down to Endgame that so many of them are really left alive. You're sort of surprised at the beginning of Endgame. Okay. That's a decent team. But again, if you're dealing with 27, if you lose 13, you still have 13 left.
Well, think about how far we've come. Again, I always point to, like, X-Men in 2000, where we had to put everyone in these black suits because spandex were silly looking.
Right.
Everything had to be grounded and as close. Even the original Iron Man is, like, far more grounded. Now we're dealing with, like, time travel and so many different characters and multiple planets and dimensions. And everyone in the audience is keeping up with it. Everybody accepts it. Everybody's going along with it. Everybody, these are the most popular movies in the world. I mean, it's like we've reached a new bar for nerdiness, like mainstream nerdiness.
Right, but there's another, you could easily come up with another word for what you're talking about. Because say what you want, the average comic book reader is pretty sophisticated.
Yeah.
And a great reader and a great consumer of narrative. So ultimately, in terms of being a big film fan, what the Marvel films may have done is gotten a mainstream audience to a point where they can accept and follow
right.
a lot of things that they couldn't yeah. follow 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And here's why that's significant. Because you know that I taught film study for decades. And for decades, I had students who wouldn't buy it if it wasn't real.
Okay.
That was their only, I've talked about this endlessly, yeah. that was yeah. their only critical scale. Oh, that's so unbelievable. That could never happen. And I used to say that's why they hated musicals, because musicals have all sorts of things that couldn't really happen. But could it be that the immense popularity of these comic book fans are actually expanding people's consciousness where that's not going to be their sole scale anymore? That they're going to be a little bit more open-minded about what they'll accept in terms of the parameters of a narrative.
I love that idea, and I absolutely hope it's true. The cynic in me immediately begins to process what I've seen as the inverse of that. And I don't think it's Marvel's fault, but I think what I experience now when I teach film is students being bored by almost anything because it's not enough. But that's not just Marvel.
It's not
that's
big spectacle.
That's YouTube and the internet and phones. And I'm not being grandpa, but like, they don't have the patience for something that's just a story.
Because in terms of following a narrative arc, which we're talking about, and I don't think I'm in spoilers yet. When time travel begins to be discussed in Endgame, many of the characters can only see time travel in terms of movies
right.
that have dealt with time travel.
Right.
And I thought that was delightful because I think that's the way a lot of us.
Of course. What other frame of reference do we have?
And that's why the scene in Looper between Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis is the greatest thing on earth,
right.
where Bruce Willis says, we're not going to talk about that. But in Endgame, and again, I don't think I'm in spoilers.
But you can be, because we announced it.
They bring up Back to the Future,
right.
which is a lot of people's touchstone for time travel. And that is discussed, and it is suggested that Back to the Future is bullshit. And maybe it is. But remember in Back to the Future 2, where the game they're playing is, we're going back to scenes from the first movie and revealing that there's something else going on because people went back in time. And then Endgame proceeds to do the exact same thing.
I was delighted when I realized that that was what was going to happen.
Yes.
That, and when they jokingly say time heist, I was like, I'm so down for Avengers time heist, because I went into this movie, I had seen one trailer, and it was mostly Tony Stark on the ship in the first 5 minutes of the movie,
yeah.
thinking he's going to die, and it's real dark, and it's Steve Rogers saying, this has to work, I don't know what we'll do if it doesn't. And it's like, oh right, because the last movie ended on a real bummer note, and so is this movie going to be 3 hours of sort of morose, bummer darkness?
Which I thought too when I saw that trailer.
Because it's the dark before the dawn, and you'd think, okay, we're going to get 3 hours of dark, and then in the last half hour, okay, great, and we fixed everything, and it's back to normal. And to their credit, no, they made a movie that's actually really pretty light and fun. And I mean, my jaw kind of dropped because my son and I, he was very excited to see this movie.
And I was glad because he was very bummed out by by Infinity War.
Yeah. We had been talking all week. He would ask me, how do you think they're going to beat Thanos? And I said, I don't know. I have no idea. And in the first 10 minutes of this movie, they chop off his hand and chop off his head, cut to 5 years later. And I was like, I have no idea where this movie is going. No idea. I had seen images like from toys and in some of the advertising of them in the special suits. And I thought, okay, they're going into space for something, not realizing it had anything to do with time travel.
And that was the second trailer that suddenly had them all walking in the line.
Right.
In the suits. What you said about the end of Infinity War is famously downbeat. Good Lord, did it bum people out for months and months. And that you were happy and I was happy that Endgame is much lighter,
yeah,
much funnier. But I think ultimately that's what I think one of their bigger triumphs is, that clearly people like this movie. Several of them went to see it last weekend. But the more I think about Endgame, and I'm not suggesting there's only one theme, there's multiple themes. But the theme I picked up the most on is that this is a loud, long, happy, entertaining movie about loss.
Sure.
That is a theme that this film is not ashamed to talk about.
Not at all.
In a lot of different ways. So talk about a spoonful of sugar makes right. the medicine go right. down. We have what is essentially a comic book romp in Infinity War that's incredibly moving and jarring and sad. And then they do exactly the opposite with mm-hmm. Endgame, where it's up and funny and I love that guy. And it's a 3-hour meditation on loss.
And like loss of family, loss of a loved one. I mean, there's so many parental relationships throughout the movie it's about getting to see your loved one more time, sort of these borrowed moments. It sort of announces that right off the bat. Again, the 5 years later thing knocked me off my feet because I didn't expect it. And kudos to the marketing for not – they show you the first 10 minutes of the movie.
And that goes along with what I was saying about loss, because once we get 5 years later
– we're in a support group.
Right.
Run by Steve Rogers.
And that's his way of coping.
Right.
And then the film proceeds to show us – it's like a psychology textbook. Here's how people deal with these things. And my favorite one, might be my favorite thing in the entire movie, is Thor's reaction. Thor gone to seed. Thor becoming a gamer with an alcoholism problem.
It's such a crazy, bold choice that seems too silly to
and
work.
And it's so tossed off that I almost missed it, but Dana Stevens ruined it in a review. When Iron Man refers to the gone to see Thor as Lebowski.
Yeah.
And my wife was saying, he had the sweater. That's clearly part of the inspiration. But again, we're laughing and it is funny. It's presented very funny. I love it when Rock Guy says, oh, Thanos? Oh, no, we don't talk about Thanos. That's the worst Taika Waititi impression you'll ever hear. That... like it or not, that's how a lot of people deal with depression and loss. So it's really good that they showed the panoply, because on the other side, we have Tony Stark.
Right.
And Tony Stark's reaction is, no thanks. Glad I'm still alive.
Right.
Count me out.
Right.
Which, in terms of the narrative, is a genius move.
Yeah.
When you consider the end of the film.
Yeah,
and I won't spoil that.
Which is fine. We're in spoilers. We have to talk about the ending. Did you find it moving?
Incredibly.
Yeah.
Incredibly moving. Even the small things, like having Gwyneth Paltrow's hand alight on his heart thing.
Yeah.
When the light goes out. Again, because this is a huge commercial enterprise, when the camera tracks back at the cabin and we see virtually the entire cast there at the funeral, I wondered if they got them all on set at the same time or
digitally composited.
Oh my God.
It's insane. And again,
there was one character I couldn't quite place.
I had to look him up. Do you know who it was?
I believe it was Quicksilver.
No, Quicksilver's dead. Quicksilver died at the end of Age of Ultron.
So that's not him.
No. So I had to Google it.
But we're talking about the same guy.
And as soon as I typed in who was the random, the first six Google hits were who was the random kid at the end of Endgame? Who was that guy in Endgame? So that was an actor named Ty Simpkins who played the little boy that befriends Tony Stark in Iron Man 3. He's like the precocious kid that mm-hmm. they kind of have a little thing together. So he's a teenager now and
that's
looks
a nice
different.
Shout out.
Yeah, but again, it was like I found myself very confused because, okay, I know who all these people are. Wait, who's that? And the camera kind of pauses on him long enough for me to say, huh? That's who that was.
And I think I jumped to Quicksilver because back then there was that copyright
problem. Right, there were two Quicksilvers.
Were two Quicksilvers.
So, again, talk about being at peak nerdiness. Like, not only do we have this movie that's doing all this crazy stuff and it's making all the money in the world, but also look at the actors who are signing up to be involved in this. Whereas once it was a little bit ghettoized to be in this comic, this silly comic book movie.
You should want to. And one of my favorites, because I think he's been in two or three now, is William Hurt, who I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
And once they do his hair that way and put him in a suit, I may have said this on the podcast before, and they give him that mustache.
Yeah.
He looks like a Marvel Comics drawing of that. I mean, he really, more than anyone else. It's like, oh, you don't need an Iron Man helmet. You got this, William Hurt.
Again, it's a curtain call for everyone and just another testament to look at what we have accomplished. Look at, you know all these characters. You like all these characters. Look at all the actors we have playing these characters. They all mean something to one another. And that's what I liked about the movie, is that it really dialed back, I think, a lot of the action. There's actually very little action in the movie.
Which is what I was referring to before when I said, I ascribed it to, we have to keep 27 balls in the air at the same time. We can't spend any time on any one fight. But I think that's another reason. I really liked how at the end of the long tracking shot, we get Jon Favreau and...
That was one of the scenes that killed me.
And I thought that was really respectful.
Yep.
Because Favreau directed the first Iron Man.
Yep.
And if that movie hadn't taken off,
right,
we might not. I had forgotten his character name, and later at Buena Beef, I had to look it up because I knew it was ridiculous.
Happy Hogan.
Yes. But yeah. I thought
and
that was really
shout out
nice.
To the cheeseburgers in the first movie, too.
Yeah. That... Dana Stevens mentioned this in her review. There's a scene during the final battle scene where a whole bunch of the female superheroes are lined up and they're going to do something. And good Lord, my audience responded to that.
Really?
It was like, oh, I mean, really. During the final battle, remember, I saw it Friday morning the day it opened in the IMAX theater where most of us had bought our tickets 2 weeks in advance. So I think these people were here to see the movie. Because when certain characters showed up for the final battle, there were three contingents who got applause.
Sure.
So there was that going on. But
I thought it was meaningful that the first one through the gate was Black Panther. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah. That Dana Stevens mentioned a short-lived comic book. And again, I'm not a comic book fan. But she said it was called Lady Liberators, and it wasn't very popular. But for a while, Marvel had a series where it was the female superheroes joining together. And she thought the shot where all the female are going to do something. But on the way home, my wife came up with another theory. We were talking about how the film is about loss, and frequently about loss of family members and father figures and mother figures. And there's a lot in the film about kids. So my wife wondered aloud if Marvel, at some point in the near future, is going to set something up. Don't laugh. I think she's on to something. Where Captain Marvel's friend's daughter.
Yeah.
Iron Man's daughter.
Yeah.
Ant-Man's daughter. And Hawkeye's daughter.
Little Avengers.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think they would do it?
I don't think anything's off the table right now, honestly.
Also, I think my wife may have found one continuity error in the time travel-ness. Ant-Man comes back. Good to have Ant-Man back. I like Paul Rudd. And he tracks down his daughter, who has aged, because she didn't disappear, and she's 5 years older.
She seemed older then, but go ahead.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the exact theory. So the people who were disappeared by Thanos originally snapping his fingers, when they're brought back at the end because they undo it, they haven't aged 5 years.
No. I don't think so.
Okay, because she was wondering why when Peter Parker goes back to high school.
Right.
His friends are still in high school.
Right.
So because only half of the high school would have disappeared. So because you were vanished for 5 years, you have to go back and finish high school.
I guess, yeah.
And obviously we don't know everyone in his high school, so as long as his best friend is there, we're like, okay, right. Well, he came back. That's sticky, I think. But
sure.
Again, you could argue that if you're thinking things like this, you shouldn't sure. have gone to see the movie.
And for all I know, because I thought about this for Far From Home, which is coming out, but Far From Home may take place before Infinity War. I have no idea.
Right.
I kind of like that we don't know exactly what the plan is right now. You know, for years, Marvel has announced we're doing yeah. this movie this year and this movie this year. We know that Spider-Man's coming out. Beyond that, like, there's going to be a Black Panther 2.
Oh, there's got to be.
Right. But, like, we don't know much else, and I kind of like not knowing exactly what's coming.
Again, going back to my point about this being a large corporation's product as well as a work of art, I had certain questions as I watched the film. Number one, why does Captain Marvel get a new hairstyle?
Because that's how she looks in the comic book.
Oh.
She has more of like that short haircut. And I was happy to see her show up because watching this movie, I was just happy anytime anyone showed up. When Tessa Thompson shows up as Valkyrie, I'm like, oh, cool. And when Taika Waititi's Rock Guy shows up, I'm like, they got everybody, man. This is great.
Because for 10 years, they've been making movies about characters that we like to watch.
Right.
Brie Larson was on a talk show, and I found it interesting because I certainly didn't know this. She made Avengers Endgame before Captain Marvel.
Oh.
So she was talking about the challenges involved in that.
Right.
Because they would give her a script page that was heavily redacted down to her line. And she said, the director said, she's all alone on the soundstage. You need to look at him, her, and him, and then say your line. And she said, I'm going to need some tape marks to show
right,
me
yeah, right.
where to look.
Right.
And keeping that in the back of my mind, I'm watching Endgame trying to find the scene with the tape marks. It's the scene where everyone's...
Where she's a hologram?
Yeah.
Yeah, I figured.
And they're talking to Black Widow. But my other question was, Mark Ruffalo is an actor that I have a lot of respect for. And he was really the first respected actor. You said, you know, that actors originally thought this was ghetto stuff or something that signed on. And I thought it was because of Ruffalo and some tweaks to the writing that they were finally able to get Hulk to work. Because certainly we have two Hulk movies that I thought were disappointing. Does it have something to do with his availability or his contract that the Hulk is portrayed the way he is in Endgame? I found that very odd. I mean, I liked it as a twist.
I liked it, yeah.
Especially because we spend all of Infinity War waiting for the Hulk to show up.
Right, and they decided this movie he's going to be all Hulk, no Bruce.
But unless he was on the set, and Chris Pratt released a video today on Twitter that he was not supposed to take, and in fact, in the video, Chris Evans looks at him and says, illegal. Chris Pratt posted it and said, they told us we were not supposed to do this. But on this day, I thought this was way too important not to get something. And it's a scene where a whole bunch of them are in a crater during the fight.
Okay.
And it kind of reveals some of the ways they did it, because some people are in partial makeup and some people
right.
aren't any makeup at all
right.
and it's basically just Pratt panning the camera so you can see, oh my god, it's like oh,
right.
did he get all 27? And I don't think he planned it this way, but the shot ends on Sean Gunn and there's a pause, and without missing a beat, Sean Gunn says, I'm pretty sure I'm the most famous person here. So it's really delightful. But when the camera passes Chris Evans says, you know, you're not supposed to be
right,
doing this.
Right.
And I thought this was interesting because Chris Pratt is such an upright guy.
Right, right, right.
That I guess once the movie makes $1.2 billion, Marvel's like, no, it's okay. He took out his camera. But it made me. Oh, and the reason I bring this up, besides the fact that it's a great tweet and a great story, is Ruffalo's in that shot. So was he on the set? And then they,
to do the motion capture?
And then they replaced him. It seemed like an odd choice because except for the scene with Tilda Swinton, which I immediately put down to Ruffalo, I'd really like to do a scene with Tilda Swinton.
Right.
He's CGI for the whole movie.
But maybe he was there doing the motion capture for all of it. I mean, obviously his face has been mapped because the Hulk looks so much like him.
And I don't have a problem with that choice.
Right.
But the minute you make that choice, I wonder, is that narrative or is that availability?
My guess is it was narrative, honestly. And I like that he's another example of a possible response to loss and grief that he kind of goes inward and finds some sort of peace that allows him to sort of be both Banner and the Hulk, that he's like found himself sort of as a way, as a response to everything that's happened.
And that leads to that wonderful scene where we're back in, oh my God, there's so many movies. New York is being attacked.
The first Avengers. Yeah.
Where he sees the way the Hulk used to act.
Yeah.
And is going to replicate that, but his heart's not quite in it, so it's like...
Feels like it's gratuitous. Oh, we just sort of half-heartedly
even when he tears his shirt
things.
Yeah. That was a wonderful scene.
The Captain Marvel stuff is one of my only sort of nitpicks with the movie, because as thrilled as I am to see Brie Larson appear in anything, and to have Captain Marvel show up in this movie, I feel like both appearances work and are cool. The first time where Tony Stark sees her outside the ship and she's who rescues him, because how else are we going to rescue him? And then the second time when all of a sudden all the guns on the ship during the battle stop pointing at all the heroes on the ground and start pointing at something in the sky. And my son turns to me and says, I know what that is. And we know who's coming. And she's been built up as so powerful that you're just like, oh, she's going to beat the shit out of Thanos. This is so great. But both times it's kind of a deus ex machina where it's like, how do we get out of this? I don't know. Captain Marvel shows up.
But in a weird way, on a narrative level, don't they have to do that? Because A, Captain Marvel's the character who the filmmakers don't have as much experience with as the other characters, but also it's sort of the Thor problem until they came up with some ways to humanize Thor. Captain Marvel, in the reality of this universe, is so fucking powerful.
Right.
The halfway through the movie, they explain it to her. Right. You know, there's a lot of other planets.
right.
That you can't have her there all the time, or else it would be Captain Marvel kicking ass while the other 27 watch.
The other thing that I was not as crazy about was the way that Black Widow's death was handled. And partly because it was just such a repeat of what we saw in the last film with Gamora, and partly because... I don't know. I guess I understand it in terms of sacrificing herself and trying to atone for all the bad stuff she's done. And I just, that was an emotional beat that did not land for me.
And my wife, after we saw the movie, read a review where the critic, looking at the film through a single lens, which I think is always a mistake, completely misread that scene. And basically said, and why does Black Widow commit suicide? And that's not what's going on.
I mean,
there.
In a this way is it not, is, but that's not
she's
exactly.
She's
right.
clearly sacrificing right. for the greater good.
Right.
The lens through which this critic was looking at the film, I don't want to open this can of Marvel worms, was feminism.
Okay.
And she had a big problem with the way the film portrayed women.
Okay.
She thought every single one of them was subservient to a man.
Okay.
But, I mean, in terms of the franchise, in terms of business, in terms of narrative, I think Iron Man gets the moments that he does because that's the through line of the whole series.
Right. Yeah, and it's always
argue,
sort of been the Iron Man and Captain America story.
And this is when I turn into a fanboy. Whatever writer came up with, I am inevitable.
Oh, my gosh.
That's I'm not a comic book geek, but I was like, oh, I hope that guy got some extra money that week because that's such a great line. And I think I didn't spoil it. I didn't give the other half.
Again, we're in spoilers.
I know.
It's
just
fine.
I want people to enjoy the film.
But if anyone's listening at this point, we've already ruined everything. So, yeah, I thought that exchange was great. And didn't expect myself to be moved, because as much as I've liked Iron Man and Robert Downey Jr.'s performance, I knew that some character was going to die.
Sure.
And so, okay, I guess it makes sense that it's him, because then, hey, there's no way I'm coming back, guys. Him and Chris Evans both. It's like, no, for sure, we're done. We've written it in such a way that we can't come back.
But also on a practical standpoint, and I don't mean to be an asshole about it, Robert Downey Jr. is getting a little old to
sure.
play Iron Man.
Sure.
Just in terms of the physical demands of the role.
I'm actually really excited about the prospect of an Anthony Mackie Captain America. I really hope we get that movie.
Yeah, I like that moment.
Or at
a lot.
Least Avengers with him as Captain America.
Yeah.
I think that's really, really cool. There's so many things that I'm like, I want to talk about, because even Nebula, a character who was like a second tier henchman in the original Guardians of the Galaxy, has grown into this character that we really like.
Yeah.
And we get the scene of her playing paper football with Iron Man, and you're just like, I'm on board for all of this. I'm on board for all these people.
And also the scene with Gamora.
Oh, yeah.
We end up as sisters.
Yeah.
Which, oh, God, it's very moving. Where was this going?
Just me nerding out about all the stuff I like. I couldn't believe how much of the movie, you know, the little post-credits scene in Ant-Man was him being shrunk down into the whatchamacallit,
the quantum realm.
The quantum realm, thank you. I was like, the multiverse. No, that's not it. The quantum realm.
That's where Adam Risky lived.
and everyone else disappearing, and he's stuck there, right? And it's just this little thing like, uh-oh, how's Ant-Man going to get out? And it ends up to be the inciting incident for the entire movie, because that's how he figures out time travel. I don't know. I really appreciate how many things were paid off.
Yeah.
This isn't new to me. I heard it maybe on another podcast, but there was a moment in Captain America Civil War where Black Panther and Hawkeye come face to face, and Black Panther's basically like, who the hell are you? It doesn't matter. I don't care. And in this movie, we get him saying, pass it, give it to me, Clint. Like, I know your name. I respect you now. And that whole last action sequence isn't about fighting off all the different little CGI monsters. It's just about who's got the gauntlet and playing that game of football,
and
moving
it. And
who
can more successfully move it down the field.
Right.
And who can handle the final coup de grace.
Right. Which, again, I thought was this movie does a lot of things right. It works in all the ways that it needs to.
I agree. And from a very practical standpoint, I can't remember another 3-hour and 5-minute movie that didn't feel like 3 hours and 5
yeah.
minutes.
It's funny because it ended and Erica said, like, when are we going again? And when she said that, I was like, oh, I don't know if I need to go again. You know, like, it's a 3-hour movie and I feel like I kind of got everything out of it. But now we're talking about it and I totally want to go.
No, I really want to, because in preparation for Endgame, my wife and I watched Infinity War again.
Which I did not.
On demand.
And I should have.
And that would be the second, that was only the second time I saw Infinity War. And that felt long.
Okay. It's another one that I so rarely revisit these movies, even though I like them.
I have the A-list, of course, and unlimited time. So I will go back and see it.
I want to go see it in real IMAX.
But the... it was something.
Because it's real IMAX,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I incorrectly, based on Twitter, guessed the theater you were at, and then Charlie set me straight.
Okay, good.
I thought you saw it at the Dolby Cinema AMC. You were at Marcus Adams.
Worried. That was the only place I could get seats together.
But there's another reason to see it at AMC, because AMC was giving out stuff. And you already got the posters,
yeah,
which I didn't need. And they had a special tin popcorn bucket with all the Avengers on it.
That's cool.
No, it was like, oh, I want one of those. I thought they were going to upcharge for it, but, well, they do, because it's like, this is the large. That's funny. It doesn't hold as much, but Jan's going to turn into a planter, and that's going to be the centerpiece on the picnic table this summer.
Very nice.
As all of you listening can tell, we really, really like this movie.
So if this is the starting point of summer,
Yes.
Because, again, summer moves up every year. So although, now it's halfway through April, and we're getting a snowstorm, and the summer movie has started.
Someone I know, because I thought Marvel kept creeping up the beginning of the summer movie season.
Yeah.
And then I think it was Jake looked up when Iron Man opened.
Okay. That was later in the summer.
Okay, then maybe I'm...
I think.
Maybe I'm thinking of another Marvel movie.
Okay.
But as it turns out, in terms of the entire series, April is not... April is only early if you, like me, remember summer movie season starting every
right.
year on Memorial Day.
Right.
But that's long.
Well, then it creeped up to the beginning of May, like going back to Spider-Man, I
right.
would say. And then, like, Fast and Furious and Infinity War and now Endgame keep creeping up earlier into April.
Right. And I'm all for that because, as we're going to discuss in a couple minutes, January and February is traditionally a dumping ground
yeah.
for films that they have no hope for, films that they thought might be award-worthy, but then they didn't open them in time for the awards, all this other stuff, because I think some people in Hollywood think that people in the hinterlands are using January and February to catch up on award
and
movies.
And they often are, yeah.
That only opened around Christmas.
Right.
And certainly this year we've seen that January and February is just a graveyard.
Yeah, again, every once in a while, as a genre movie fan, something will sneak in.
Oh, sure. And like I said, not a hopeless year, but my first response thinking about the year was, this has been a bad year. And then I went to my list.
Okay.
And as we'll discuss soon, it's not a bad year.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like I've seen some stuff that's okay. I don't have a single favorite. And I usually do by now. I would have at least one that, like, okay, that might show up on my list at the end of the year.
And yet, I may have already seen three films that could very well be the worst film of the year.
I know one of them because I'm looking at the list of what came out, and it stars Matthew McConaughey.
And oddly enough, I wrote a column on Serenity because, as those of you who follow the site go, I am not Mr. New Release. But this movie, what's the word people use? This movie is batshit crazy.
Yeah.
And it was like, I have to write this column to exorcise the film from my psyche. And I don't know very many people who went to see it. I believe Risky went, because Risky sees everything, and he agreed with me. But someone wrote a comment on my column where they said, I'm into this form of entertainment that Serenity is a riff on.
Right.
And that made me enjoy it. So who am I?
Sure.
Serenity is just as bad as the day is long. And then to show you how bad Mary Queen of Scots is. Mary
oh,
Queen of Scots.
Geez. You saw Mary Queen
I
of Scots?
I sure did.
What the hell?
You know why?
A-list.
The A-list. It's Wednesday.
Right, I guess.
Clearly someone thought Mary Queen of Scots might be Oscar worthy because it's based on history right. and it's like Masterpiece Theater. And a very beautiful woman is really doing a job on herself, which we love. And so 2 weeks ago, I was scrolling through on demand on the cable and I came to Mary Queen of Scots and I said, oh, do I want to see that? And then, thank you for laughing, beat. Oh, I did see that.
I thought for sure you started watching it and then realized oh, you saw it.
That would have been insult to injury because...
You would have paid for it twice.
Yeah. Well, I don't consider A-list to be paying for it.
All right.
In composing this list, there's a tab you can press on the AMC website where not only does it show you every ticket you bought, I thought it was going to be like that wallet where it shows you
right.
with fake ticket stubs. No, there's another option. It's like, this is for your accountant at the end of the year. It not only shows the tickets that you've bought, but when they went to your credit card and took the money.
Oh.
So it's like a ledger.
Got it.
So you can actually go through it
right.
and say, okay, I paid this on this date, and then
right.
I saw this many movies. Ka-ching. You can actually tell what months you yeah. were you really gamed the system and what months you were like, well, I should have gone to see some more movies. Mary Queen of Scots
month,
is so bad, and it shouldn't have been, because there's a germ of an idea there comparing these two rulers and the way they went about ruling. And I think that's what attracted the actresses, but it's as bad as the day is long. And then Holmes and Watson.
Oh, right. Which technically is a 2018 movie.
Which is now, well, yeah, that's the first
out,
movie
I think,
I saw
on Christmas,
year.
Right?
Yeah. Someone weeks later,
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
guessing when it went to
said it was,
on demand.
They thought it was funny, right?
This was right up my alley. Yeah. So, and I hesitated to comment back. And I don't want to insult this person.
Sure.
I really don't. You enjoyed it? Thank Christ
yeah,
there's
right,
one of you.
Right.
But the comment made me wonder, and again, I'm not making fun of anyone. This is actually what comes into my head. If what comes into my head is inherently cruel, I'm just as God made me. What is your alley? I mean, really, it was just,
listen,
I was flummoxed by the fact.
Some people like Southland Tales. Some people like Under the Silver Lake.
Although, and this for me was a triumph, and this is what I love about our website. He did admit that I was right about the plot.
Oh, there you
he
go.
Said, okay, I'll grant
right.
you.
Right.
But that might not be the point. So far this year, Holmes and Watson, Mary Queen of Scots, and Serenity, it doesn't get better than that. And at some point, you know you have to see Serenity. You know you have to
yeah.
see
yeah. Yeah. I mean, cable, probably, or Netflix or something.
It'll get to the point where it's
yeah.
free.
Right.
Although, in today's society, free is not free because it's 2 hours of your precious life.
It's funny because I'm looking at the list, and I know that I need to see more movies again to just get more value out of my A-list. But again, scheduling and health and all these things keep me away.
But A-list, and I don't mean to interrupt you, A-list is set up. My wife and I are convinced it's the health club model. Oh, I'm going to lose weight. And then you
right.
sign up and then you never go.
Right.
So you wouldn't have gone in the first place, but now they're getting $20 a month from you. But to make A-list pay, you just have to go twice a month.
And I think I have.
I mean, really?
Yeah, I don't think there's a month where I've lost money.
That bar is pretty low considering how much they're charging. How much were your Marcus Endgame seats?
Oh, I don't remember. Probably like $9.
Okay.
Because it was an early show.
We went to the first show of the day, and it was the IMAX theater.
No.
So I think they
one IMAX ticket pays for
exactly. So
for
this
A-list.
Was 13.
Yeah,
and
yeah, no one IMAX or one Dolby. Like I'm so glad those are included because that kind of pays for the A-list.
And I'm afraid I find myself in that grandfather mode of talking about penny candy or something, because when I was in high school, as you could imagine, movie theater admissions were much lower.
Yeah.
But there's something about your psyche where just like sometimes the music you like is the music that you enjoyed in high school and college, in my mind, a movie ticket should be about $4.
Right.
And that will never change.
Mm. Yeah. It's substantially
more. Like when my brother bought his first car, and for the next four decades, I thought, oh, well, that's how much, seriously, was a Ford Mustang.
Yeah.
And this was a long time. This was a long time. You were not born. He paid $4,000 for it.
Wow.
And I swear to God, for 30 years, if a car was more than $4,000, I was like, how can that be? A Ford Mustang. Maybe I just have brain damage.
So I need to see more movies, but I'm also looking at the list of what's come out, and there are very few that sort of escaped me in terms of, oh, I really wanted to see that and missed it.
Here's what you need to do, and I think, and I'm talking to our listeners because I already know you're adept at this. Nancy Drew would have passed me by if it weren't for you, because of course they didn't spend any money on advertising,
right?
And I think around here it was on one screen,
probably.
And you had tweeted about it, and the director very nicely responded to the tweet and said all these wonderful things. And in one of the tweets, she said they actually got 100 more screens than they were originally promised.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to oversell it, but Nancy Drew is delightful for a number of reasons. And it's something you need to see. And I especially think that children of a certain age need to see it because it does a lot of things right.
Yeah.
And it's sort of against the children's movies that I think Patrick and I hate. And I had a similar experience, and I think I've talked about this before on the podcast, so I'll keep it short, that Vincent D'Onofrio's directorial debut shows up at Streets of Woodfield for, I think, a week. And I have an afternoon. And I went to see it, and it's not a masterpiece, but it is really good. It's one of the better films I've seen this year. It's called The Kid, and it's a Western. So, A, that's why you have to go, because you have to support that. But, and I've talked about this before.
I think so.
Because on a previous podcast, it was What Have You Seen Lately?
Yeah.
But obviously, you really have to pay attention, because in both cases, we're talking about contractually mandated releases, and God knows it might just wind up in Nebraska. But I'm really glad I got to see both of those films in a theater.
Yeah, I mean, Streets is good for one or two of those a week.
Yeah.
And they're usually something that's also hitting VOD the same day. And sometimes it can be hard, especially for me with kids and everything, to justify, even though I want to see it in a theater, it's like, yeah, but I can just wait till everyone's asleep and watch it here.
I remember the day where I discovered that about half of what's at the Music Box
is often.
Oh. I want.
Yeah,
I want to support
right. It's hard, right? I want to see this on a big screen, and
it's a two-hour drive.
But it's a commitment. So
and then I read Rob and Adam's review of the drive-in movie,
yeah.
And so I think within an hour of reading their column, I was watching it on demand, and I wished I lived closer to that place.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to going sometime so I can meet those crazy people. And Adam said he's going with Rob, and I don't want to be a third wheel, but I was like, what exact weekend were you going?
I think it's next weekend.
Because I could pop in like Iron Man.
Have you watched Out of Print yet?
Yeah.
Okay. When you were talking about the New Beverly, I was thinking about that and talking about the fetish, and I was thinking about, oh, the guy with gloves that pays in $2 bills and made me want to turn off the movie. But I fought through it. I fought through it.
The guy at the drive-in who really likes to talk about film, and the employees are saying, I'm never quite sure what to say to him, although he always has something to say, and halfway through the film, he's volunteering and working there for free. And he actually, this is something I won't spoil, you all need to see at the drive-in. It's magnificent. He has the last word in the film. Do you remember what it was?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, just, I forget the name of the filmmaker. It's very well done. And it asks this great question. They're all working for free. At the beginning of the film, they're all working for free. Why would someone do that? And then the film manages to answer that question. It's not on my list, though, because
they could have interviewed us, and we could have given them the same answer.
Oh, you just blew my mind.
Yeah.
That's not part of my list, of course, because I still have that anal retentive desire that the list is theatrical screenings.
Well, it's not a movie from this year, so that's really the issue.
And I don't keep track of the other ones. But
like your Buster Keaton movie, that would be from this year, right?
Right, but I saw that. That's not on the list.
But it counts for 2019.
But I'm beginning to think I should count it and expand my horizons because...
Yes. If I didn't count stuff I watched on VOD, I would see nothing.
Have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't.
You all need to see it.
Yeah.
There was a previous documentary called Buster Keaton, A Hard Act to Follow by David Gill and Kevin Brownlow. The problem is it's out of print and it's 3 hours long. It is lengthy. It's narrated by Lindsay, the filmmaker Lindsay. It's on the tip of my tongue. I, of course, own it because I bought it on Laserdisc before that went out of print. But the fact that Peter Bogdanovich put this together, the fact of who they got to sit down and talk before they died.
Yeah.
You all need to see it. It's called Buster Keaton, A Celebration.
I really want to.
Even though at this point you still have to pay a couple bucks. It's not.
Yeah, right.
It's a rental on.
Which is fine.
iTunes. It looks really good too. They spent some time getting good looking prints of the old stuff.
Do you have any favorites of the year so far? Because I don't feel like I do.
Well, again, that throws me into a quandary because I see so much old stuff.
Right.
That we now have to sort of decant that. And I could say, well, yeah, Casablanca on January 7th was something. And the Alien screening that you hosted was terrific.
Yeah, it was.
I enjoyed Captain Marvel. I took your children to see Ralph Breaks the Internet.
That's
and
right.
That was 2 tons of fun. And I saw Gone with the Wind in a movie theater about 2 weeks after you did because that came back for its anniversary. And then the F-This Movie Fest, which I'm now going to consider a theatrical event, and the previously mentioned The Kid, and then you left the house. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
That's
that was
okay.
Juicy. I'm going to have to boil this. You and Erica went to Sci-Fi Spectacular this
year. Yes,
yes. Which was, I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, it was.
Because we've had some quibbles with the Sci-Fi Spectacular, but, and I shared this with you before, it seemed like this year they were trying to say, the people behind it, we can do this right.
Right, right.
And this could be delightful and comfortable and not something with a leaky roof that we canceled.
Right. And no heat.
So I thought the Sci-Fi Spectacular was so much fun this year. I really...
Time After Time is one of my favorite new discoveries of the year so far.
And I actually think of all the films they showed, besides the large appreciative audience for Phantom of the Paradise, because of course they had Garrett Graham there, the film I enjoyed most all day long was Village of the Damned.
Really?
I just really enjoyed watching that in a
all
movie
right.
theater.
I had never seen it.
With a crowd of people.
That and Omega Man and Time After Time were all new to me.
And for its 40th anniversary, Life of Brian got some theatrical screenings
which
around the country.
About.
Although mostly at IPIC theaters. And I was angry because I waited too long, so I couldn't sit in the ultra fine place where there's waitresses. I had to sit with the hoi polloi and in fact sit in the first row.
Oh, wow.
Which is always problematic. But what was really strange was all the fancy expensive seats with waiters were folks and their kids.
Interesting.
And I'm talking about 8-year-olds and 10-year-olds.
Yeah.
And I'm not a blue nose, but Life of Brian is rated R.
Right.
And I thought, this is odd. Is this dad saying, this was really important to me when I was a kid, but he's thinking about when he was 15, and he's going to drag his kids to see it. But then after the screenings, I saw some people tweeting about it, and it really seemed that the kids were digging it for the right reasons. One father specifically noted some of his daughter's reactions and the stuff that they liked and everything, and that the youngest daughter at the stoning scene turned to dad and said, I think they're all women. And how much the kids liked it. And the fine folks at Monty Python had this little envelope full of paper goodies that you got, which was kind of fun. And after the screening, I made a beeline for the box office and said, are there any more? Are there any of those left? Because they were only handing them out at the Thursday night screening.
Right.
Are there any of those left? Because I got a friend who really likes Monty Python, and she
the
handed,
friend is me.
She handed them two more. She handed me two more.
Nice.
So now I have to decide which of my many friends likes Monty Python the most.
You should give them a test.
And who would want this?
Yeah, like a written test.
Not to spoil it, but I'm thinking Aspergillator.
Sure, yeah, yeah. That's a good one. That's a good pick.
Aspergillator.
He won't listen to this, so it's fine.
Oh.
I'm just kidding. He might listen to this.
Aspergillator and I were on, we were texting each other on Record Store Day because I was in L.A., which made it a whole different thing, and he was in Boston. And he was traveling, so he didn't get to enjoy Record Store Day. And then the next day, he went record shopping in Boston and was saying, you know all those things you said you couldn't find? They're here.
Mm.
So my son, I know this is a movie podcast, but
what was the name of the record store, do you know, in Boston?
I do not.
I'm kidding.
I wound up, joke name?
I don't have a, no, well, I mean, my joke name for any Boston record store would just be like Wicked Fackin' Records. Good.
I wound up going to Amoeba, of course, and a place called Permanent Records. I went to two different locations of Permanent Records in L.A. And my son was saying the basic principle of Record Store Day is flawed because a lot of these are limited editions, so some of them are going to a place where people are like,
right,
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, right.
Because he was looking for something super obscure, like crazy obscure. And it's like, well, it's a pressing of five. Within an hour of the record store's opening, Jake was texting me pictures of the item on eBay for five times.
Oh, my gosh.
The asking price. It was $30. It was an EP by a band I've never heard of. Within an hour, $150.
This is the problem with being a collector of anything.
Yes.
We are at the mercy of assholes.
But again, this is why Aschbergschlager deserves a Life of Brian pack.
Good point.
Aschbergschlager found Jake's EP.
Yeah.
And the picture disc of the Life of Brian soundtrack.
Very nice.
So you see, it all folds together and we go back to movies. We do.
Any,
it all comes back to
movies. Are
there
any other 2019 movies that have stood out?
Okay. Aquaman was pleasant when it was playing, but it's no great shakes. Glass is very problematic. I saw Glass
with
you.
Boy, is it? Yeah, you did. And Adam, who really liked it.
And I'm glad someone did. I thought Lego 2, the second part, which I believe...
You saw that with us, right?
I would have had to.
Yeah. Vanished out of my memory
now,
the minute it was over.
Well, it's got that one good song.
Yeah.
That's
the song Rosie's dancing to, you know.
I know.
Oh, okay.
I can't go to these... Without you
children,
guys,
yeah,
because can
sense.
You imagine? Right. Hi, I'm a real big fan of this director's work. You going to eat
it's
all those gummy worms?
Fine.
So I would actually say, and I'm perusing the list one last time, and I've seen a lot of stuff this year.
Yeah, but like I just don't think there's any standouts.
I would say that as of April 26th, Avengers Endgame is the best movie I've seen this year.
Yeah,
hands
I mean,
down.
Me too.
And someone else was on the Twitter machine, and I didn't get the point they were trying to make at all. It had something to do with the end credit scrawl. I don't get the connection, but the tweet was basically, looking at the end credit scrawl of Avengers Endgame, they're bucking for a Best Picture nomination.
What?
I don't...
Yeah.
Really? That's determined by the end credits?
Okay.
I didn't know that.
I didn't get that feeling either.
But again, it's April. I see more movies than the average bear. Could it?
I don't know.
They wound up giving the award to the final Lord of the Rings film as a sort of valedictory of that whole
series.
Yeah,
but hadn't the previous ones been nominated?
Maybe not. I don't think so.
No, you might be right. I don't know. I would be surprised, but who knows? Anything still coming that you're really looking forward to?
There's a couple things coming out. Obviously, John Wick Part 3.
Yeah.
Oh, good Lord.
Hello.
Trailer for that? Holy shit.
I don't even need to see a trailer. I don't care. It has the words John Wick in the title. I'm there.
And every time I see the trailer, and I've seen it many times, I add a little thing
Thank
just
you.
For you
Thank
in
you.
My mind. He's back to kick your dick.
Why they didn't go with that for part three, I don't know.
It's the movie with, where's my brain? Because AMC just offered me free tickets to a sneak, and it's the day after tomorrow.
Booksmart.
Yeah.
I got that same email, and I was real mad because I have to teach.
Booksmart looks
see
interesting.
It. Yeah.
Again, the whole thing with we sent this email to a million people and it's first come, first served, even if you reserve tickets, makes me squeamish.
Yeah.
Because, of course, next week I have A-list and unlimited time.
Right.
But it's nice when you go see an early screening.
Yeah.
I saw a very long trailer for the new Fast and Furious movie.
Yes, I did too.
Hobbs and
Shaw.
And... with all due deference to your love of the series.
No, listen.
That trailer looks like everything that's wrong with movies.
I won't disagree with
today.
You. I have that reaction to the Men in Black International trailer, but same idea.
Every time I see the Men in Black International trailer, here's what plays in a repeating loop in my mind. We couldn't get Rip Torn to come back. We couldn't get Tommy Lee Jones to come back. We couldn't get Rip Torn to come back. We couldn't get Tommy Lee Jones to come back.
How can they make me not want to see a movie with Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson as the two leads?
Well, here's how you do it. Because it looks, and I may be wrong, we haven't seen it.
Nope.
I could be all wet.
Maybe it's great.
It looks so craven, and so Tessa Thompson is walking through the thing, and we see the little wormy guys again, saying, I think, almost exactly what they say. So it's the film. Hey, remember that thing you like?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, very much. Ooh.
Naturally, the most anticipated. We have a new Brian De Palma movie coming called Domino. We have a movie that I'm sure you and I will be podcasting in just a matter of weeks, Godzilla, King of Monsters.
And again, we were not kind to the Godzilla movie that came out a few years ago.
Rightly so, I would say.
Because both of us know Mr. Doherty.
Yes.
I think that's going to be the key. Because we've actually met Mr. Doherty.
Yes.
A long time ago before he was crazy famous and he had just made Trick or Treat, which is delightful. So I got a good feeling. Although the trailer looks real generic.
And just fighting in the rain. Now, to be fair, I think I only saw the first trailer. I think two trailers have come out since. I haven't watched them because, again, all they're going to do is spoil things that I'm going to see this movie. So why do I want things spoiled for me? So
I was in L.A. a couple weeks ago, and we got a wild hair up our ass. And even though it was very expensive and very foolish, we were like, we got a couple hours. Let's go to Universal Studios. So we did. And it was like the end of the day. So we were paying like X for X. And it was not a good deal. It was a foolish decision. But my wife and son went to the Harry Potter attractions, which I am prohibited from riding. Thank you, Universal. And I went on the tram.
Okay.
And this time I got what I've taken the tram dozens of times, and this was the best guide ever. She was an elderly woman who loved what she was doing and had Universal's history down pat. It was an amazing journey. It was the best tram tour guide experience I've ever. It was. I wish I could remember her name because I wanted to write Universal a letter. Like, why don't you have all the guides get on the tram and have her do what she does and say, don't copy her, but this is what it should be. This time when we drove through the Western town, she went on and on about the 3 weeks that Quentin Tarantino spent. That's where they filmed the Western stuff on the Universal backlot. And it's some of it's in the trailer.
Yeah.
He was there last summer for 3 weeks.
Wow.
And every part of the tram tour was like that, like not this scripted nonsense.
Right.
In fact, there's these video cutaways to Jimmy Fallon.
Fun.
She didn't show any of
that. Oh, wow. Fuck that. I'm not playing the Fallon stuff.
Oh, no.
I'm bumping Fallon.
No, there's one for the Western part that's just embarrassing. But when Jan heard this, she was like, not even at the end? Because the one Fallon thing that Jan likes is at the end of it, he sings a song.
Okay.
And the song is funny and catchy. And I'm like, I didn't realize it till I got off the ride, but she didn't even play.
She went rogue.
Have a tram-tastic day. And the way it was set up, there was obviously some space where the other tram went into King Kong, so we had to wait. And didn't faze her at all.
Wow.
She was like, you know, you can see her on the little monitor. She sat back. Oh, I have stories to tell you. I have stories to tell you that when this fucking tram trip is done, you're going to remember the story, not King Kong. That's how great I am.
Yeah.
And I wish I had written her name down. It's like, oh my God, this is what this could be.
So that every time you go again, you request Sheila.
Ask for Babs.
Right. Two more that I want to mention. One is Jim Jarmusch's The Dead Don't Die.
And thank you for bringing that up, because when we walked out of Endgame, there's a big cardboard stand-up for that in AMC. And you just look at it and you're like, those marketing people were really smart, because the tagline says something about the best cast ever disassembled or something.
Right.
But holy shit.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's good.
You used to see this with Woody Allen, who, of course, we're not allowed to talk about anymore. Yeah. Imagine being a director with such a cachet that people really want to work with you.
Right.
Because clearly that's what's going on with this. Yeah. Holy shit. How can that movie be bad?
It could be. It could be.
Speaking of Jarmusch, two of his better early films just became available on Criterion Blu-ray. And Stranger Than Paradise is like the film when I was in college that introduced me to indie cinema. Because I went to see it and it was like, this is not like,
right.
I've never, oh my God. Talk about a film that wouldn't be made today. It's just, do you like that movie?
I do, yeah. I like pretty much all of his movies, although I've never seen Limits of Control.
I love Stranger Than Paradise in the way that I love Eraserhead, in that it seems like Jarmusch and Lynch sat down and said, what do people want in a movie? I'm not giving you that. I'm not going to do that.
The other movie doesn't come out till September, so we'll actually have done our best of summer show before we get to September. But it, aside from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it's my most anticipated movie of the year, and that is It Chapter 2.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I know.
They made that
it's already coming, and I could not be more excited for it, too. And I really hope it's good and doesn't ruin my affection for It Chapter 1, a movie I've watched a lot of times.
Really?
My kids are asking to watch it.
Well, I wanted to bring this up.
This is a new thing that's happened.
Rosie is very...
She wants to see Us and It. This is what's walking into Endgame. The other day, she said, the two movies I want to see are It and Us.
Rosie,
she's six, everyone.
Is very happy that she has a bigger capacity for horror films than Charlie, obviously. This is one metric where I win, because I went to those two movies with Dad.
Oh,
and you and you didn't.
That's right.
Oh, no, when they're at our house. And that's what she was talking about today. And I said, you know that those movies are really scary.
Yeah.
They're really scary.
Yeah.
And It is rated R.
Yeah.
She's like, I could handle it. And then she said, I watched The House with a Clock in Its Walls. And I said, well, excuse me, but...
That movie's for pussies.
No, I didn't say that.
Oh, good.
I
Thank
said
you, by the way,
something
for not
like this.
Introducing her to
that
word.
Because, of course, I don't talk to them like children. I never have. I talk to them like adults.
Yeah.
Same with Jake.
Yeah.
I said, I have it on very good authority. Your father told me that there was a scene in The House with a Clock in Its Walls that really scared you. And what happened with her face is my favorite memory of today. She was going to be defiant and say no, and then she caved and she smiled and she was like, yeah, that happened. And then wasn't it you who said, this is the part I couldn't get straight, that it was the pumpkin attack that got her back.
She wanted
on board
to leave. She said, can we go? And I said, oh, just stick with it for as long as you can. And then the next scene, I think, was the pumpkin attack.
Right,
and from then on, she was fine. She was having a great time.
I love the fact that Rosie rightfully sees these movies as, can you take it?
Right.
Can you handle
right.
it? Because at that age, but I told her, Us is very, very scary.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be showing her Us.
And It is rated R. And especially because this is something I'm sensitive about. I forgot that Us was R. It shows children being terrorized.
Yeah.
And I just think you have to be careful about that.
Yeah.
Charlie didn't know that the ratings are a suggestion for parents, and that legally, if you went with him, he could see an R-rated.
He thought he couldn't see an R-rated movie?
I said,
oh,
you have to be with mom or dad.
Right.
But the whole thing is so that mom and dad can decide. He thought it was the law, you know? So
I'm going to take him to all kinds of R-rated stuff now.
Please don't.
I'm not going to.
Because
I was seeing, like, Predator at his age.
In my time teaching film study, one constant was the dad who held these things close to his heart and showed the kid The Exorcist when she was five. I have heard that story.
Yeah.
And I used to go to Blockbuster and see these kids begging their parents to rent these films. And again, I don't think they would be permanently damaged. I just think children deserve to have a childhood. You have your whole life to watch that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make me a prude or something?
No, I don't think so. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is because Charlie's still stuck in kids stuff right now, you know, aside from the occasional Avengers Endgame. And so I'm just trying to figure out what that middle ground is of stuff that will capture his attention but won't
but
be
we're
too
discovering,
strong.
We're discovering a pattern here because two very good friends of ours, each dad has a daughter who wants nothing to do with this and another daughter who's way into it and that's something she shares with dad.
Yeah.
I've heard this. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Which I find fascinating. In fact, when we visited one of these people in L.A., the younger daughter was telling me, oh, I love that stuff. Dad and I watch that stuff. And we're not talking about something that's
right
inappropriate. We're just the father in question was really glad to have
a partner
in crime for them.
Anyway, that's going to do it for us.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for listening, as always. Thank you, J-Bones, for talking about all this stuff with me. It's always fun.
You're welcome.
As always, read us every day at fthismovie.com. Follow us on Twitter at fthismovie. We're on Facebook. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, yesterday's column. That was really good.
Yeah, it was. It sure was. Anyway, thank you guys. We will talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.